Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. Today on Counterspin, most of the tales of murder and rape that came out of the Katrina catastrophe in New Orleans never happened. But that didn't keep news media from conveying endless accounts of mayhem supposedly perpetrated by black thugs and gangs. Our guest says portrayals equating crime with African Americans reflect a time-worn pattern, even when the stories are false. We'll talk to author and political analyst Earl Ofari Hutchinson about race, lies, and New Orleans. Also on the show, the Judith Miller saga is just one of the stories that raises questions about the relationship between the press corps and the Bush White House. Ward Harkavy tracks such stories for his online column for The Village Voice, called The Bush Beat. We'll hear his thoughts on the Miller case and on at least one other story involving Dick Cheney that seems to be flying under major media's radar. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press.
Those who complain about the media approach that puts firmly established science on an even footing with dubious or untestable claims have Exhibit A in the October 6th New York Times. The paper placed on page A1 a nearly 3,000-word piece by Jody Wilgorin, which perfectly exemplified the he-said-she-said-so-no-one-can-really-know method. The story followed two rafting trips through the Grand Canyon, one led by a creationist group called Canyon Ministries and one sponsored by the National Center for Science Education. Get it? The first group talked about the sandstone formations as evidence of the global flood described in Genesis, while the second saw things, as Wilgorin puts it, through the lens of science. It's not at all clear what the Times thought it was doing here. The piece is just human interest details about the two groups. One woman says maybe God's footprints are in the canyon. One man wears a hat bearing the Christian fish symbol, but with the word Darwin in it. Wilgorin appears never to have seen this image, which has been appearing on bumper stickers for decades now. And the reporter's glosses fall flat. She paints the science group as, quote, disrespectful of religion, close quote, but then acknowledges in the next paragraph that a quarter of the group say they belong to churches or synagogues, and so on. Readers are most likely meant to find the justification for the piece in the line that the two rafting groups represent, quote, opposite ends of the growing creation-evolution debate, close quote. The trouble with that, of course, is, as a letter writer to the paper pointed out, there is no debate, growing or otherwise, about evolution or the geology of the Grand Canyon. Creationists and others who put forward alternative explanations have not supported those claims with scientific evidence, period. It's interesting. When it comes to journalism, outlets like The Times seem to have no trouble stating definitively what does and doesn't qualify, yet they can't seem to hold on to that clarity when it comes to the rather older endeavor of science.
On October 9th, Parade Magazine, the Sunday newspaper supplement with a circulation of 34.5 million, making it the country's most widely distributed magazine, published an inaccurate smear about Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The smear, appearing in the Q&A column, Walter Scott's Personality Parade, was a response to a letter writer who wanted to know, quote, where Fidel Castro gets the dough to shore up his bankrupt regime, close quote. Scott explained that since the Soviet Union's demise, quote, Castro has turned to Hugo Chavez, Marxist president of Venezuela. In addition to shoring up Castro, he's funding revolutionaries and terrorists throughout Latin America, close quote. For such a short response, it's wrong on several points. Chavez is not a Marxist. As he told the left-wing publication Counterpunch in August, quote, I don't believe in the dogmatic postulates of Marxist revolution. I don't accept that we are living in a period of proletarian revolutions. Are we aiming in Venezuela today for the abolition of private property or a classless society? I don't think so. Close quote. And while Venezuela does provide discounted oil to Cuba, more than 20,000 Cuban doctors are sent to work in Venezuela in exchange, making the relationship mutually beneficial. As for funding revolutionaries and terrorists throughout Latin America, the U.S. State Department, no less, does not include Venezuela among its list of state sponsors of terrorism in its country reports on terrorism. The report does say that it is unclear to what extent Venezuela might support any of the combatants in Colombia's long-running civil war. It also says that the Colombia and Venezuela governments have cooperated on terrorism-related cases, and that several Venezuelan National Guard officers were reportedly killed by FARC forces near the border between the two countries. Some media seem to feel that it's simply open season on Hugo Chavez, but journalism does have standards. Parade should provide evidence for their charges or issue a retraction.
It wasn't so long ago that John Bolton's nomination as ambassador to the UN made front page news, with papers like the New York Times devoting days of coverage to the contentious confirmation battle and the potential implications of appointing a fierce critic of the UN to serve in the international body. So now that Bolton has been officially installed, through a recess appointment, readers might expect to see close coverage of any controversial moves in his new post. One such move came on October 10th when Bolton blocked a special advisor on the prevention of genocide from briefing the Security Council on the recent escalation of violence against civilians in Darfur. It was a startling move, but the next day's New York Times gave the story a scant 150 words pulled from the Reuters newswire. And the only rationale suggested for Bolton's peculiar behavior was the one put forward by Bolton himself, that the council, quote, had to act against atrocities and not just talk about them, close quote. The item closed by hinting at what might be a more logical explanation, noting that the envoy was to have reported on Sudan's lack of cooperation with the International Criminal Court, a body the U.S. strongly opposes because it could make U.S. soldiers or officials vulnerable to prosecution. A more serious story might have begun at that point, particularly given Bolton's record as a leading critic of the ICC, which he once called not just naive, but dangerous. But only a handful of papers even mentioned Bolton's maneuver, much less noted that, as the Los Angeles Times reported in April, the Bush administration has been quietly allying itself with the Sudan to acquire intelligence data and access to terrorism suspects. One more reason why Bolton's block on a report about rights abuses in Darfur should have prompted tough questions.
When there's an imbalance in employment, if women, say, or ethnic minorities are underrepresented in some industry or profession, conservatives generally dismiss discrimination as a possible explanation, arguing that, by and large, people are hired for jobs on the basis of their skills and experiences. And if some groups turn out to do better than others in whatever field, well, that's just how a meritocracy operates. There's one situation, however, where some conservatives do believe that underrepresentation is itself virtually proof of discrimination, and that's when it's conservatives who are underrepresented. Thus, you have conservative New York Times columnist John Tierney writing up a study by conservative activist David Horowitz, complaining about cronyism in prestigious journalism and law schools, because, Horowitz says, he found that registered Democrats outnumbered registered Republicans at these institutions. In other words, it's discrimination because it's them being underrepresented. Tierney does allow that, quote, to some extent, this is a problem of self-selection, close quote. Few Republicans work for these institutions because few Republicans apply for jobs at these institutions. But what if that's not the case? Top academic jobs are highly competitive, and at least in theory, applicants are competing on the quality of their ideas. Why isn't it possible that Republicans seeking these jobs have been passed over because their ideas weren't as good as those of other applicants? That would certainly be the standard conservative explanation for the situation if we weren't talking about conservatives.
And finally, starting October 10th, CBS Evening News began a new series called The Homefront. Reporter Sharon Alfonsi described it this way, quote, for the next 2 weeks, we are going to be driving across country, talking to Americans about how they feel about the war and how and if it's affecting them, close quote. Since the most recent CBS poll shows widespread disapproval of the war, you'd expect the series to reflect that. But that's not at all clear from the first stop, a meeting with new Marine recruits in South Carolina. After one recruit said that he wanted to fight against the people who committed the 9/11 attacks, reporter Alfonsi said they were hearing a lot of that, and she added a peculiar comment, quote, politicians will argue whether the war and 9/11 are related, but clearly, here, to these recruits, the two are inseparable, close quote. What's that supposed to mean? It's well established that many Americans are possessed with the unsupported idea that Iraq had something to do with September 11th. It's baffling that a reporter can't set the record straight. The fact that new military recruits are citing the connection for a reason for enlisting only makes correcting such misperceptions all the more important. The next stop for CBS was meeting military families in Fort Benning. But by the third installment, they had found some war protesters in Birmingham, Alabama, where CBS pointed out they reflect a small minority. If CBS's road trip reflects actual public opinion, of course, such voices won't be the minority at all. We'll be watching.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Most of the New Orleans horror stories alleging rape and murder amid the chaos of Katrina never happened. But you might not have known that at the time if you were depending on mainstream U.S. media for your news. Many of the poor who were left behind in the catastrophe were African American, and media images largely suggested that the mythical brutality was the work of black thugs and gangs. Our guest says this sort of coverage repeats a time-worn pattern. Quote, New Orleans fit neatly into the standard equation that black, especially poor black, equals crime and violence. That equation kicks in even when there is no crime or when whites commit the crimes. Close quote. Earl Ofari Hutchinson is an author and political analyst. His column, Race, Lies, and New Orleans, can be read at alternet.org. He joins us now from Los Angeles. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, welcome to Counterspin.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's begin with the debunking of those early stories about widespread rape and murder. Tell us a little bit about that.
Actually, about 3 days after Katrina hit, I became aware that the news media had latched onto one thing. This image of terror, violence, murder, rape, we can go on, and certainly looting, in New Orleans. So the mainstream media right away framed this as really just a city in chaos, where you had just marauding bands of young African Americans just taking advantage of a situation to pillage. Well, you know, the world saw those scenes, the very few scenes of looting that were certainly looped over and over again to create this image of just bedlam and mayhem. The problem with that is a Guardian correspondent in Baton Rouge who actually went into New Orleans, who actually went to the Superdome and actually took the time to look at police reports, did some interviews to find out, really, is this what's happening in New Orleans? Do we really have a scene of murder, violence, chaos, pillage, and so forth? And what he found was simply the facts based on the reports, based on the eyewitness accounts, simply didn't support it. What I found interesting about that is this happened 3 days, and his report came out, and by the way, it wasn't just a left-leaning tabloid, as some try to dismiss it over there in Britain. Also, a reporter for the Associated Press and the Chicago Tribune essentially confirmed the same thing. Yes, there were some incidents of violence. No one is saying there wasn't, but just this total picture of a city that's just out of control just simply didn't happen. About a month later, we find that now there's a mea culpa on the part of the mainstream media. What I found even more interesting when the mainstream media said, well, everything was exaggerated there, it took 30 days. They already had the story. It was already there weeks before. So the big question in my mind, and certainly anybody that takes the time to look at this objectively, is why didn't the media report it at the time? And why did they continue to run with this same distorted image of New Orleans 3 weeks after the facts were in?
You say that this sort of reporting that equates African Americans with crime, fits a pattern. Could you give us some other examples of where this happened? And I think this gets at the reason why they were so late in correcting the stories.
Well, I'm out here in Los Angeles, and instantly when I saw that Guardian report, it resonated because going back 13 years, we had the L.A. riots, uprising, whatever you want to call it, after the Rodney King verdict. We saw the same thing in Los Angeles, where the national and international media jumped on this image of African Americans out of control, burning, looting. Well, obviously some of that went on. But what was missed in the context of this, and this came out later on in the back pages of the Los Angeles Times, when they looked at, once again, the numbers, not just the images, but the actual numbers, in other words, the facts. In this case, the arrest reports, they found that the typical profile of a looter and a rioter in Los Angeles was not a young African-American, but a young Latino and, surprise, surprise, a young white. That was reported nowhere because the media already had their image, the image of blacks out of control, the violent young African-American. We've seen this scenario replayed time and time again.
Well, you know, I think it was the Los Angeles Times also that did some important reporting about how even per capita drug use is higher among young whites than among young blacks.
Well, a classic case of that is something that happened very recently. And again, let me throw a caveat in here before I say this. You know, I think when you're talking about drugs and the drug war, it's only a $9 bill. It solves nothing. All it does is basically just feed the prison industrial complex with a lot of basically poor young people. Classic case of that, where you have that double standard again and also used to perpetuate this myth about blacks, crime, drugs, violence in America, was the hostage mom in Atlanta. A young white woman, of course, that talked a black murder suspect into surrendering. Well, as the story unfolded, she was portrayed as a hero, but she was also a meth addict. And I thought to myself, very interesting. No arrest, no prosecution, no big deal made of this. She's still a hero. Now, when I said a caveat before, I think drug use in America should be decriminalized anyway. It's a medical problem, not a criminal problem. But still, we can't ignore the double standards that we see time and time again in the reporting of crime and violence and how it's depicted.
Well, I want to ask you about a related issue. On his national radio show on September 29th, Bill Bennett, the former Reagan official, remarked that aborting every black baby in this country would reduce the crime rate. Now, Bennett was presenting this as a hypothetical situation that he called morally reprehensible. But nevertheless, isn't this just another example of drawing a simple equation between crime and African Americans?
Well, you know, one of the better comments I heard about that is probably if someone had aborted Tom DeLay, then we might have stopped some of the other crime that we see in the halls of Congress. And I guess we can go on with Ken Lay and some of the big corporate thugs in America, which shows how ridiculous it is. However, the point is, it's no accident that Bill Bennett made this intemperate remark, which resonated. And by the way, if you noted, there were a lot of folk that jumped in and essentially defended Bill Bennett. No accident that it came right on the heels of Katrina and New Orleans. Again, embedded deep in the minds of much of the public, I don't want to overgeneralize, but far too many of the American public across all lines, is that when you're talking about crime and violence, it's black.
Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson, how can journalists puncture this bigoted and entrenched mindset that seems to affect their profession as much as it does the rest of U.S. society?
Well, just simply report the facts. The Guardian reporter, a reporter for the Associated Press, and a reporter for the Chicago Tribune actually took the time to debunk the myths. Now, what has to happen is other journalists have to have the same guts. They have to have the same moxie. They have to have the same sense of objectivity and fairness to do essentially what they're paid to do, namely report the facts, not gossip, not rumor, not innuendo, and certainly not slander. If more journalists who can call themselves professionals, if they would act like professionals, I think we'd be a lot further down the road to eliminating, certainly not all, but certainly many of the stereotypes and the negative typecasting, always based on race and ethnicity.
We've been speaking with Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson, political analyst and author of The Crisis in Black and Black. You can read his column, Race Lies in New Orleans, online at alternet.org. Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson, thanks for joining us today here on Counterspin.
And thank you.
In the midst of new twists and turns in the Judith Miller saga, some people have noted that the New York Times, Miller's own paper, hasn't exactly been on top of the story journalistically, allowing themselves to be scooped on developments in the case and inviting concerns about whether their fealty to Miller outranks their responsibility to their readers. But the Miller tale is just one of the stories out there that raise questions about the relationship between the Bush White House and the so-called mainstream press corps. Our next guest digs into just those sorts of stories in his column, The Bush Beat, for The Village Voice Online. Ward Harkavy is a senior editor at The Village Voice. He joins us now by telephone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ward Harkavy.
Thanks a lot, Janine and Steve.
Well, we won't ask you to give us chapter and verse on the Judith Miller story. We're bound to revisit it on this program as the investigation proceeds. But in a recent column, you were struck by the contrast between the way the Times is treating that story and the attitude expressed in a column by the Times' public editor, Byron Calame. Can you give us some of your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I guess I find it always fascinating to see how the Times covers itself. Miller has taken a lot of heat, obviously, and she's a key figure in the Plaingate scandal. So one would expect that the paper would be kind of in a damage control mode. But the column A column, the public editor's column, was, I thought, funny. And funny in kind of a tragic way. Instead of focusing on the Judith Miller case, which is, I think, what readers want to know. What did she know? When did she know it? Who did she speak with? Carl Rove, Scooter Libby, whoever. The public editor chose to write about the readers of the Times, and he told us how they were nice and upscale and that, oh, they were very curious. And of course, I find that all very funny and also very curious because who cares?
The readers are curious, but we're not going to give them anything to help them
with
that curiosity.
Yes, the reader, well, and of course, the other thing that's quite annoying about the Times' approach to this is that the story by the public editor made it sound like, well, gee, they're curious. You know, they're upscale and they're educated, and when you're educated, you're curious. Well, I'll tell you what. I have friends who aren't very well educated. I have friends who aren't very rich, and they are curious too.
Well, the Judith Miller story for some people is a kind of complicated one. You had a recent column, though, about something that I think is much easier to grasp and yet somehow is not being talked about, as far as I know, in major media, and that is Vice President Dick Cheney's ongoing relationship to Halliburton. Now, we all recall Cheney declaring that he'd severed all his ties to that company. Tell us what you've learned.
Well, I have to give all the credit to the wonderful NGOs and watchdog groups and the people who are online really digging this stuff out. They continue to point out, of course, that you know, Dick Cheney still gets paid by Halliburton and that his stock options in only the past year have increased more than 3,000% in value. And at the same time, of course, Cheney has contended, as he told, I think, Tim Russert it was on Meet the Press a couple years ago, that he has no financial interest in Halliburton. Obviously, that was not true. And the thing that's frustrating to me is that this is not material that I've uncovered. This is material that other people have uncovered years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Lautenberg, the New Jersey senator, was the one who has really been dogging Cheney on this, at least back in 2003. And he's the one who asked the Congressional Research Service for an opinion as to whether this was in fact true, that Cheney has no financial interest. And the Congressional Research Service came back and said, well, yes, he does have a financial interest. In other words, he has to disclose this. This is relevant. And I don't know why the press is not hammering away at this. I will say, however, whatever you call the press these days, it's very diffuse. There are people who continue to point this out, like Halliburton Watch, like the Ross story, like many, many other organizations and independent journalists. Lots of people pointed out. I don't know why it doesn't make the evening news.
Well, let me draw you out on that bit in the last question that we've got time for, because things like Cheney lying flat out to Tim Russert, as he did in 2003, and whatever this dance is that's going on with Judith Miller in the White House, I think things like this contribute to a certain cynicism and frustration with the, maybe we call them traditional press corps, and a hunger for new sources of information. And I note that in your Bush Beat columns, I see a lot of these online sources, places like the Raw Story, the Next Hurrah. Is it your feeling as a journalist that the location, if you will, of journalism is moving?
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it. I don't know where it's moving to, except away from newsprint. I guess I would go to a story I read yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, which I would say the Wall Street Journal is probably the best newspaper in America today. And I'm not talking about the editorial page, because I don't read any newspaper's editorial pages, if I can help it. But I mean, just as a model of in-depth reporting and wonderful writing, the Wall Street Journal is a must-read for everybody, in my mind. if you want to keep up, if you want to know what the schnooks are doing, then you read the paper that they read. And yesterday, the Journal pointed out that newspaper companies are really suffering financially and that the price of newsprint is going up, up, up. And then I would point out that while the price of newsprint is going up, the price of memory chips is always, you know, decreasing. So newspapers are in big trouble. And I think that journalism, on the other hand, is not in big trouble because it definitely is shifting locations. And a journalist is where you can find it. In other words, all kinds of people are practicing great journalism and not just on newspapers. Some of the NGOs like Halliburton Watch, the Human Rights Watch is doing a great job of journalism in actually investigating torture cases in Iraq and so on. And these days we can get those facts directly from these organizations, which is wonderful for everybody. Now, the problem is that this stuff doesn't make it onto the nightly news or onto the front pages of newspapers. Well, I think these days you just have to go beyond that for your sources of news.
We've been speaking with Village Voice senior editor Ward Harkavy. You can read his regular column, The Bush Beat, at www.villagevoice.com. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and the interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. Subscribe to Extra now, and your first issue would include articles on, among other things, U.S. media's misrepresentation of this country's generosity when it comes to foreign aid, the telecom industry's attempt to squelch community broadband, and FAIR's own take on why it's time to unplug the CPB. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of this program or you'd like to hear previous programs, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.